Hey everyone, John Mark here. I recently released a book called Practicing the Way, Be With Jesus, Become Like Him, Do As He Did. It's the synthesis of the last 15 years of my teaching and learning on all things spiritual formation and apprenticeship to Jesus. It's also the unofficial manifesto for this work that we call Practicing the Way and our vision of a Christian spirituality for the digital age. If you're interested in giving it a read or learning more, you can visit practicingtheway.org/book. Hello and welcome to the John Mark Comer Teachings Podcast. I'm Strawn Coleman, your host and part of the teaching team here at Practicing the Way. Each week on this show, we share a teaching from John Mark or other trusted voices in the formation space. It's great to have you with us. Today we bring you another one-off special episode, a live recording from John Mark's recent tour of his book, Practicing the Way, Be With Jesus, Become Like Him, Do As He Did. In this recording, John Mark sits alongside Matt Chandler and Bo Hughes, lead pastors of the Village Church Flower Mound in Texas, as they explore the why of spiritual formation and what it means to hit the wall, drawing from their personal stories. So without further ado, here's Matt, Bo, and John Mark.
It's so fun to be with you guys tonight. Matt, you don't even know this, but Matt's not that much older than me. But when I was just, well, he is quite a bit older, actually. When I was just starting preaching, Matt, you were one of just like three preachers that I would listen to. Thank you, Sierra. Because everybody sounded like lame. Thank you. And I would listen to you because you would like quote the Beastie Boys. And I was like, wait, aren't you supposed to be a Christian? But it was awesome. And you would talk about Bo. Yeah. And I would listen to podcasts. And so it's an honor to be with you guys.
Circle. It's kind of full circle.
Here it is. And what I've been learning about from the Beastie Boys in this season is nothing. So. This, if you see the median age here, they're like, who are you talking about?
It's probably true.
Yeah, they don't even know who Beastie Boys is.
No, they, Beastie
they
Boys
have an Apple
forever.
Documentary out there right now, so it's good.
So I've got a question, not about the Beastie Boys.
So spiritual formation.
I really wanted to let that go, and then anyway. You know, a friend of mine that's a sociologist at OU, he talks about how a dirty little secret in sociology is that a lot of sociology is biography. You know, we're studying what we're studying because of our own lives. And so when you're thinking about your burden for spiritual formation, obviously practicing the way, both the book, the ministry itself, where did that come from?
Mm.
What prompted that besides the general desire to be like Jesus?
But yeah. No, I mean, I would love to give you some virtuous answer, but it's not. It's pain and failure. So I don't know. There's so many mixed opinions about personality theories, and they're all theories. None of them are true, but they're still interesting.
Useful.
They're useful, yes. And so Myers-Briggs is one I like a fair bit, and because Myers-Briggs has been around for a while, there's a lot of data behind it. You can Google, you know, if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs, there's 16 personality types, 4 letters. You can Google your personality type and most famous movies, and they'll come up with like a little graphic that will show you each character in the movie that you are most like, right? And so it's fun. So you can Google your thing and like Google your number in Star Wars or whatever. I don't ever do that if you are mine, because I am INTJ. I am the worst. So in every single movie, I am the supervillain. Okay. So in Star Wars, I'm not even Darth Vader, because we all kind of love him and he comes around in the end. I'm the Emperor. I'm Palpatine. In Harry Potter, I'm he who must not be named. I'm in Breaking Bad, I'm who's the guy? I'm that guy. Like I'm the person you hate. You Google like my number and famous people. It's basically all genocidal communists and Ayn Rand. It's like nobody that you want to be around ever. So that's a way of saying, in all honesty, I am not naturally peaceful, happy, or kind. This is me on Jesus, people, all right? And all in all, that is not false humility. My wife is so loving and kind and merciful, but she will say to me once in a while, honey, if you were not a Christian, you would be so horrible, rich, but so horrible. And very single. And so all that to say, we all have our unique starting point in life, and we don't all start from the same place. Some of you might have a lovely sanguine personality, but your family of origin was traumatic. And so you were walking with a limp before you were ever walking. And others of us have different, I have some stuff with my nervous system from a traumatic experience as a baby that's kind of miscalibrated my nervous system that's made me much more anxious. And so we all start from our own place. And the reality was, I was a pastor who was in love with Jesus and doing the things you're supposed to do and loving the Bible and learning the Bible and teaching the Bible. And I could not be kind to my wife and my kids. And I could not be at peace in my own body. And I could not really commune with God through the distraction of my mind. And so that's honestly what drew me to formation. Is I think, you know, one of the gifts of the addiction community is their honesty. And, you know, Christians are often, there's something about evangelical culture that's profoundly dishonest. And so, you know, if you have two poles where there's like dishonest hopefulness and then there's like cynicism, where most Christians are pretty far over here. John Wellwood, is a psychologist, has this concept that he calls spiritual bypassing, which he actually developed it working with Buddhists, but it's very true for evangelical Christians, which is basically where you use spiritual language and ideas to basically sidestep and avoid facing like deep family of origin stuff, pain stuff, shadow stuff, trauma stuff, and you just kind of fake it until you make it. And so what happens with addiction is people can't fake it anymore. And so they are honest. And so all of us kind of have some moment in life, if you haven't had this yet, you likely will, where you just can't fake it anymore and you come to the end of yourself. And in a sense, like, it's why I think, I find the Beatitudes so perplexing. I've like had 9 different interpretations in my mind of what they mean, and I still can't make up my mind. But it is fascinating to me that the first one is, blessed are the poor in spirit, that what some would call spiritual poverty is the foundation of the spiritual life. Knowing I have nothing apart from God, and I need to be saved. And I mean saved in the like ancient Christian holistic sense of that word. So I think that's what...
But you're pastoring a church.
Yeah, I'm pastoring.
You've grown up in the church.
Yeah, absolutely. Great churches, lovely churches.
So what was... I don't want to say what was missing. Maybe that's the right way to ask it. But what did you not have in terms of equipping around spiritual formation to move through some of that? That would lead you then to write about what you're writing about, talking about what you're talking about, equipping the churches in the way you're intending to equip them now.
Every church sits inside a wider culture, and every church movement sits inside a wider culture. And that can be a really good thing, or a really bad thing, or a neutral thing. And so I'm not, there's no such thing as a cultureless church. And so we think, take a deep breath, you know? And, but evangelicalism, or let's just say even broader than that, the kind of American church, comes out of the Enlightenment. So our country is founded kind of coming out of the Enlightenment. Most of the founding fathers are Enlightenment deists with a kind of sort of Judeo-Christian worldview, not really necessarily. And the Enlightenment comes up with this whole new anthropology or view of what a human being is. A lot of, and some of it from Christians. So Rene Descartes, who was a Christian, you know, his famous line, I think, therefore I am, he called human beings res cogitans in Latin, which is thinking things. And it kind of developed into this, you know, this is an oversimplification, but this view of a human being as a brain on legs. You know, so what's the Thomas Edison line? The chief end of the body is to carry the brain around. And this is the cultural assumption that the American church is born out of. And that assumption was never really seriously questioned. And it's not a true assumption. It's not a biblical assumption. It's not a scientific truth. I mean, it is contrary to a Hebrew worldview, a biblical worldview, a scientific, holistic, a neurobiological worldview. It's not what a human being is. And but it's how often we just what assume a human being is. And so what I think that has created is evangelicalism and most churches, including the wonderful churches that I grew up in, are built on the assumption that as a person's knowledge of the Bible increases, their spiritual maturity will increase along with it. And there is just enough truth in that claim early in the spiritual journey to keep people believing it as an overarching paradigm. And what I mean by that is the earlier you are in your journey with Jesus, the more that is true. The higher the correlation will be between you learning the Bible and you becoming more like Jesus. In particular, as our culture and, you know, the cultural gap between what's normative, where we live and call home, and the teachings of Jesus gets nothing but wider year over year over year. So if you're a brand new Christian and you've been following Jesus for 3 days and you have yet to hear what Jesus has to say about human sexuality or money or forgiveness, learning those truths from the Bible are going to utterly transform your life. But as you begin to be transformed by a whole new kind of mental model of reality from Jesus and the New Testament writers and all of Scripture, you will then eventually, hopefully, mature to a spot where the problems that you're solving for are not going to be fixed by necessarily more new biblical learning. So let me give you an example. Like, the problems I'm solving for right now is, John Gottman's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse for Marriage. Number one marriage killer is contempt. I have contempt that at times rises up in my heart. I have a lovely wife who is way out of my league, but I am Emperor Palpatine. And, you know, he was single, just for the record, you know? And so there is contempt that, especially when I'm stressed and tired, my wife and I respond to stress totally differently. I will get grumpy and contemptuous with her, and it is ugly, and it is not like Jesus. I have an 18-year-old son who is awesome and utterly stresses me out of my mind and is polar opposite from me, and I'm like a rule follower, straight jacket. He has never met a rule in his life that he did not want to stomp on. And he's either going to be in prison or a wildly successful entrepreneur in 2 years. Hopefully the latter. He is a lovely kid. You would love him if you met him. But he is so stressful to raise and so strong-willed and provokes my anxiety like nobody else on the planet. And I will at times respond to him. He came home the other day and we got like a tardy from school. I was like, you know, were you playing hooky? What happened? And he's like, well, I went out for lunch with this girl to celebrate her birthday. It's this girl he likes or whatever. And I was like, and we decided just, he's like, can I show you, Dad? I was like, okay. He just pulled it up. He got this giant leg tattoo on his lunch break with her money. He doesn't have any money right now. And I was like, oh, Lord, help me right now. So, what neuroscientists call the automatic responses of the body and what Paul just calls sin is what often comes out of me in those moments. So my point is, those are just a couple of the problems that I'm... So, and those are the ones I can tell you about in public, right? So if I were to listen to Matt, who is one of the best Bible teachers living in the world today, exegete through Romans, I'm sure it would be good for me. It would be spiritual nourishment. But it's probably not going to fix the contempt in my heart toward my wife. And whereas early on it would have taught me this is what marriage is, it would have allowed my will to align to a lifelong covenant, it would have given me that. But now what I need is not less than that, it's more than that. So please do not interpret anything I just said as a critique of Scripture or Bible teaching. I read Scripture 365 days a year. It is utterly essential. I'm going old school. I'm getting back into memorizing Scripture again. And memorizing Psalm 143 right now. I love it. It is essential to my life with God. It's that we need more. We're more than just brains. We're more than just computers for information. We need embodied, emotional, relational, deep models of discipleship that allow the truth of Jesus to transform our whole bodies. So I'll end with this. I've rarely had this experience. Matt, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. Not really. I've only had this experience once. I was preaching, and I was teaching the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28, which is, you know, go into all the world, make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I commanded you, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And I had this almost like out-of-body experience. You know, sometimes when you're preaching, you'll just almost like see yourself. And I realized as I was exegeting through the text that I don't do what it says. Teaching, it was that line, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. I realized I teach people what Jesus has commanded them, not to obey what Jesus has commanded them. And I realized that's not the same thing. Teaching you, this is what Philippians says, do not worry. So this week, everybody, don't worry. How's that working for all of you? That is different than teaching people or learning yourself how to become the kind of person who's been so transformed in the inner depth of your being into a person who's marked by trust in God that you are free of worry over your future. That's something else. And so I think that's what I realized, oh, wow, there's not just a teaching of the what, but a teaching of the how, or in my case, it was a learning of the how, a journey that I wanted to go on.
So you're making that journey, you're moving through the pain, the suffering, you're hitting a sort of wall, if you want to call it that.
Absolutely.
And then, and Matt, I'd love for you to chime in as well in terms of just, so then you're looking around for resources. I mean, what did you do? You know, as you're realizing all these things and you're going, okay, I'm not equipped in the ways as much as I've been raised in the church. I've been a part of these discipleship structures. I've got a, you know, home group or a, you know, all these different things. Where did that lead you?
Well, I mean, the gift, I'd love to hear from Matt. The gift is we're not the first people to follow Jesus. People have been following Jesus for a very long time from all over the world. And there's lots of really lame things about globalization and the digital age, but one rad thing is I can read lots of amazing dead people, and I can learn from the best saints of church history, and I can get on a plane and go meet with people who are living today and ask questions. And there are sages. You know, Jesus said, I will send you prophets and teachers and sages. And there are sages out there. They're just often a lot quieter, and they often don't draw large crowds. Because it's a minority of people that often want to hear what they have to say. But I think I found the sages, dead and living, known and unknown, and they were able to help, you know, guide me forward. But I'd love to, I know you've been, we had lunch today.
Yeah.
You've been on a journey with a lot of this stuff.
For sure.
You know?
So for me, theology was like armor. Hmm. So coming out of some of the stuff I was coming out of growing up, it was like, I'm probably like a lot of guys like me that we just got thrown in the deep end of the pool. We just happened to survive it.
Yeah.
But to do that, you had to leave your heart way back there, and you just had to get it done. And so that was kind of how I was operating, and I was really good at it. Mm. And people praised me for it. And I deeply loved Jesus, and I deeply loved the book, and I didn't understand the brokenness in me. Sometimes I couldn't see the brokenness in me. Mm. And then it just stopped working. I don't know how else to say it. I started to have I became aware of a low-grade agitation. That's the best way I know to explain it. I'm looking at my wife for the, that's right, baby. I had a low-grade agitation that could spill over onto people. And I didn't understand where it was coming from. So it wasn't tied to sex, and it wasn't tied to money, and it wasn't tied to numbers at the village. It wasn't tied to whether you liked me or didn't like me. It was this constant. I'm like, if 9 is us in a confrontation, I'm like humming at a 7, 365 days a year. And it was exhausting. But I had all the theological answers of what to do. I really did. I even went and saw a biblical counselor. He just gave me more Bible, which armored me up even more. It was like, literally, I'm telling you, the 28 to 38-year-old Matt, it was one of the more well-armored human beings ever. It'd have been really difficult for you to bother me or hurt me in any kind of way, because I don't even know how to do that to myself. I mean, I had a theological grid that solved everything, but was also crushing me. without me knowing it. I didn't know that's what was happening to me. And so I had a series of friends fall, like disqualify themselves. And then I could feel my empathy shrinking as a pastor. So I had this terrible, I'm in my office and this guy who, I mean, wife had been cheating on him with a good friend. And I mean, he is just, but I mean, he is sobbing. I mean, snot and tears and can't hardly pick his face up off my desk. And I'm unmoved. And I'm thinking, I need to plug him in with Jason Holloman. I need to get him into recovery. I need to, and I'm just not there. I'm not in the room. And that terrified me. I'm like, something's broken in me. And I don't know what to do. And it's not read Romans 8:28 again.
You can memorize it.
Well, and that's the thing. That is old school. Maybe I will. And so I had a good friend who had been telling me about this therapist that I should go see. Therapist, bro. Got the New Testament. I don't need a therapist. And so I did, and it's leading me to the first book I read. So I'm going to see this guy in Nashville. He specializes in maybe guys like me. I don't know.
Messed up pastor.
Yes, yeah. Guys like me. So, and so he's like, hey, I want you to read a couple of books, and I want you to, and he gave me Critical Journey.
Yes.
And as a well-armored,
at a Fuller Seminary,
happy, reformed guy, that book was, I was like, this is crap. I mean, I hated that book. And I would even like tell Lauren, I was like, this guy's some kind of freaking heretic. They're sending me to a heretic. I'm not. And then, so Critical Journey, though. Critical Journey was the first one that started unlocking some things, even though I hated it. And then I think my first session with Jack, he was like, okay, I'm going to stop mentioning the Bible to you. Because every time I talk the Bible, you glaze over like you know what I'm talking about. And I don't think you know what I'm talking about. So we're going to come at this another way. And then at the end of the week, I'll tie it all together with the Bible because I know you need that. I mean, just totally read my mail. And so it's funny. Years later, I read Critical Journey again, and I could just so see myself in it in a way that, I hit the wall. That's the wall. That was what was happening to me even as I read this book.
Will you define, for those that are not familiar with it, what they mean by the wall?
So the wall is what I'm describing. It just stops working. You just come to the end of yourself in a way that you're now aware that this isn't going to work.
There's no way to fake it anymore.
No more faking it. No more, how are you, brother? I'm fine. None of that. It just, you stop being able to do it. And that's where I was. And I was there as the pastor of that time, a church of maybe 15,000 people. So I was like, well, crap, what do you do? And I was so disoriented after that first. I mean, I was discombobulated for 10 months. So I didn't know what my motives were. Is this little Matt? Is this hero Matt? Is this shadow? Is this I was so confused. Cause I couldn't make any decision. I was like, I'm not sure who's even trying to make this decision in me. And then that led me to, just to all sorts of, I wanted Sabbath. I needed to figure out how to be okay being alone. I'm an extrovert. Like we're different on that scale. So people like give me a lot of juice.
Yeah.
And so like, I don't like being alone with me. And so I had to, but I needed to mourn
me
some things.
Me is my favorite person. Yeah.
True. Spoken as the emperor. Love me some me.
Love it.
So yeah, I needed to mourn. I didn't know I needed to mourn.
Yeah.
I needed to mourn some things.
And that grief accumulates in life.
Well, it does when you're, so I don't know how you're, I'm future oriented, which means it's really hard to bother me. Or hurt me, or for me to sit in anything, or I mean, I've been through some traumatic stuff, but not for long. Because my wife and I were built really different. So I wake up in the morning, say, open up my Bible, pray, and then I'm thinking about the day, thinking about what I got to get done. Lauren will wake up, have a cup of coffee, and she'll be like, hey, last week at dinner, do you think when I said this that they thought, and I was like, dinner? Who did we have dinner? Oh, that's right. Yeah, I know. I don't think they thought that. So, but I will say this, if you're future oriented, I would dial in all the more to what's being said here tonight, because part of hitting the wall for me was refusing to feel anything because I could get to what was next. And what was next was always kingdom stuff. It was an initiative. It was a sermon series. It was all good stuff that I was being praised for, but was killing me.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know. I didn't know it was killing me until I hit the wall. And then it's been 9 years, I think, since that started. And I'm okay being with me now, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So what would you guys say? I love the quote about, you know, it's, pursuing Christ-likeness is not natural.
Mm-hmm.
In that, as you guys are moving forward, led by the Spirit, seeking help, sages, and other avenues of growth, what to you guys was most unnatural as you begin to try to address not just your head, but your body in regards to some of these things that you were carrying around in terms of how you had been shaped and formed and not necessarily toward Christ? Or even currently, what's unnatural to you in your pursuit of Christ-likeness, even today?
I think, you know, Matt, it's interesting you use the word armor.
Yeah.
I think it's a really insightful name for it. There, you know, there's lots of wise people that would say the very things that make us successful in the first half of life are what make us failures long term. And, you know, I just read Arthur Brooks. Most of you are way too young for this book, but if anybody's over the age of whatever, there's a beautiful new book out called Strength to Strength by a researcher for Harvard who does happiness research. And the basic data is that the more successful you are in the first half of your life, the more unhappy and miserable you'll be in the second half. Because the correlation is the kind of people that tend to be driven out into the world to have American success, that those very qualities that often get you out of a troubled childhood, get you out of a relationship with your dad, get you successful, get you through life. Therefore, if you build a whole life on this kind of coping mechanism, this armor, you might make a bunch of money. And at the end of the day, you're going to be miserable and possibly even a failure. And so I do think there is a role that often the armor serves to get us out of our house, to get us to get us into God's call in our life. I mean, God uses the shadow. That's the extraordinary kindness of God. He uses the shadow. But there comes a point, and this is what's counterintuitive and not natural to me, where the very things that have made you successful and have been your coping mechanisms for pain, you have to then let go of. And you have to reject him. You can say, hey, I got this far. If you're going on a long journey, you might go on an airplane for part of it and then a car. And then it got you where you are. But now you need to leave it behind to go. And so that work is harder, I think, at times for Christians because of a misreading of Paul in particular in the New Testament, you know, that would say, you know, like it's the misquote of Paul's line, you know, forgetting what lies behind, I press on toward the goal, which I was taught means like, don't think about your past. Just forget your past. Press on toward heaven, brother. And like in context, exegetically, he's talking about his accomplishments as a Pharisee in his career before he lost all of that because of the social stigma that he took on to become a follower of Jesus. So that the right interpretation is forget the lucrative career you had as a dishonest, you know, money grubber or whatever that you gave up to follow Jesus. Just forget that money and that life and that career and press on to what God had. That's the right interpretation, not like, don't grieve the loss of your mother when you were a child. Or that's not what Paul is saying, but that's how it was deeply interpreted to me. And when we began to go on some of this journey, like people, older Christians would get mad at me. It would, you know, because it's their defense mechanism. They're intimidated by it because they don't want to do it. You know, I have this amazing therapist that I've been with 13 years, I think now. And he said to me recently, we were talking about denial. And he said, denial is the most common and most effective of all coping strategies for pain. I was like, oh, let's do that then. That sounds great. Let's just shove it down. And again, it works until it doesn't work. And there's a season where you need to get up and at it. But I think what was not natural for me was letting that go and really beginning to face some of this stuff. You know, I mean, there's that super annoying millennial phrase, do the work. you know, which is so annoying. And now that so many of us are in therapy, now it's like a badge of like, are you a good person or not? Have you done the work? Or she hasn't done the work. You know, it is just so pretentious and annoying. But and that language can be really off-putting, in particular for Christians from particular streams, the Reform stream, and for understandable reasons. But if you really listen carefully to what the non-lame people mean by that, what do they actually mean by do the work? They meant that they sat with another person that they were brutally honest with, and they sat with their own soul, and they faced the things they've been running away from, and they realized they couldn't fix them, and so they offered them to God for healing. And that's really what the work, it's not really work, it's more like rest, biblically. And so I think that for me was, I literally was taught not to do it by well-meaning Christian preachers. And so that was unnatural for me. And I was taught a radical individualistic approach. You know what I mean? We haven't really gotten into it, but the communal aspect of this is absolutely massive. You do not go on this journey alone. I mean, your transformational moment was not with a book.
No.
It was with a dude named Jack.
Yep.
And most of my transformational moments were with books, but no, we're but we're with people. It is so. And again, I'm introvert, and there's this weird thing where a lot of pastors are deeply isolated and lonely. You look at the pastoral falls, and you know, I keep looking for common denominators, and I can only find a couple, and one of them is loneliness, isolation. And there's a weird deal. Either you're an introvert if you're a pastor, and so by the end of the workday, you're just exhausted and don't want to see another person. Or you're an extrovert as a pastor, but all of your relationships are dual relationships, and they're thin, and you're not really who you are. You're in this pastoral role to everybody. So you get this weird phenomenon of these pastors that know everybody and are super extroverted and are actually deeply lonely and isolated. The huge number of pastors I talk to are painfully lonely.
Yeah.
And I was able to baptize that way of living in my wider theology, and it was just horrific. And so that was really unnatural for me, in particular as an introvert, learning, wow, reading books is great, really good, but this is a relational process that is ultimately about the healing of my relational brokenness. And so learning to let other people in to the shadow is so key. So, you know, most therapists would tell you that Sigmund Freud was wrong about basically everything. But he was right that whatever it is about ourselves that we deny, we give the most power to. And so in facing the stuff in our life, in our past, in our present, in our shadow, with Jesus and with close community, it's robbed of its power. And it doesn't often fix us overnight, but it is the beginning, I think, of our freedom. So I don't know what's unnatural for you.
It is, and maybe, well, I know I'm not the, it is easier for me to believe that I am useful to the Lord than it is to believe that I'm wanted and loved by Him.
Yeah.
So my default is always doing over being, achieving over resting.
Yeah.
It will, I mean, a decade into very serious work around that wound in me, it's like I've come so far, but it's a haunting, it pursues me, that to be useful is to be valuable. So the whole thing feels unnatural to, you know, I just got back from 3 days by myself. I don't know. Like, there are times I go out. We have a little ranch out on the Brazos River, and I quarterly just silence and solitude out there. But man, there are times I get out there, and I, like, as soon as I get there, like, the spirit's there, and it's like a high five, and it's the coolest 3 days of my life. Or sometimes it's me just like, I've got so much to do. Lord, do you have anything to say? I'm just like reading Genesis over and over again, trying to show me some, what are we doing out here? But I've even learned that uncomfortable, awkward, alone time is, and I think this is Tyson, I heard Tyson say it first too, it's like expanding my capacity for Him later on. It's still it's still an exercise in presence to wrestle, to try to be in His presence. But easily for me, the unnatural thing is, why don't you just sit here with me, Matt? Let me tell you how I see you. That feels unnatural. Mm. Because let me do for you. Let me accomplish for you. That's like, that almost feels hardwired in me. So that's the unnatural. And you could apply that across every discipline. That's the unnatural for me. If I'm useful, I'm lovely. If I'm not useful, I'm not.
I did this on my last sabbatical. I did this 21-day guided solitude retreat. And it was this old program. It's been around for 50 years. The guy who leads it is ancient, and he went through it as a PhD candidate. 21 days, they put you in this cabin on the water, and there's strict rules. So there's no food. You literally turn in your devices. And no alcohol, no more than one cup of coffee a day, no exercise is allowed, nothing to, quote, discharge anxiety from your body. You bring all of your own food, cook all of your own food. Your only contact is every morning at 5:30 a.m. You do an hour and a half of depth therapy 5 days a week, which is kind of like normal therapy but without the happy feelings at the end. And one of the strong rules is you can't bring any books with you. And he said the Bible is allowed but discouraged. And I was like, excuse me? And he's like, well, I will allow you
Jokes
to bring...
Jokes on them, you memorized it.
That's right. It's like, oh yeah, you can't take that out of my brain. he said, we just don't want you... He's like, you're allowed to bring your Bible, but we don't want you to use it as a distraction from God. And so then I asked him, like, why no books? Books are like a huge part of my life with God. Like they're like, it, like I, it's half praying after that. I love, like, it's a huge part of my formation. And he said, this is our attempt to recreate the desert. Speaking of solitude, the desert of Jesus, the desert of Moses, the desert of Elijah. And he said, the desert teaches by taking away. Yeah. And I realized I only know how to learn by addition, not subtraction. I only know, like, let me read this book, let me listen to this podcast, let me listen to this conversation live, and let me put more in there. And that is a crucial part of learning. But there's a whole other part of learning that comes in solitude and deep relationships that's about stripping away and revealing what's there, which is often beautiful but often ugly, and being loved by God and other people just as we are, you know?
John Mark, let me ask you this, and then we can open it up.
Yeah, let's do that.
For you guys to ask questions. But both of you guys were just talking about solitude, but you did mention the communal aspect of it. So thinking specifically about groups of Christians, maybe particularly in local churches, trying to address some of these gaps that you guys had experienced that led you on the journey that you've been on, what can the church do? What is the church doing or not doing? I know there's a whole ministry that's been created to address that, I think, that's called Practicing the Way. But why don't you riff on, just a vision for the church. How can we do the opposite of teaching people to forget what lies behind in the non-biblical way that you just described, but actually equip them to move toward what you guys, at some level, had to figure out on your own?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the gifts of the church is the church can be, in its most common permutation, an incredible place to receive teaching. And teaching is an essential part of discipleship. Jesus was a rabbi. He was a teacher. And so it's an incredible place to receive teaching. But I think where the breakdown often comes is the teaching is too informational and not formational enough. You know, so the early church had two rules. They had the rule of faith that was started with the New Testament and then was codified later in the creeds, and was basically, this is what Christians believe. If you are a follower of Jesus, you believe this, and it was the essentials. And then they had a rule of life that was, you know, the first example is called the Didache, and then it is later codified by Augustine and Benedict and all that. And this was basically like, this is how we live together as a community. And most churches today all still have a rule of faith. We call it a statement of faith or a doctrinal statement. You go to pretty much any church in the world, and if you dink around on their website, and you will find some page that has a doctrinal statement. It's like the core, this is what it, if you are a Christian, you believe in the Trinity and the resurrection of Jesus and the pre-tribulational rapture, and you know, just the essentials, and they're like, you're in or you're out stuff, you know, and so they'll have it there. But there is rarely a rule of faith, like, and this is how we live. We love our enemies. We fight off materialism. We live deeply together in community. We stay married through the highs and the lows till death do us part. We submit to, like, that isn't there. And it's not that Christians don't want that or pastors don't want that. It's just fallen out. And I think that tells you so much about what's transpired. So my personal case, you don't have to use the language of rule of life, but I think that churches can become training grounds and schools where people are able to architect together a more holistic model of discipleship, or what early Christians called a rule of life. And the weird thing about rule of life, so a bunch of my books about rule of life, there is this tiny little micro resurgence of rule of life in the Western Protestant stream of the church. It's small, but it's growing in popularity, and I love it. But it's all being run through the grid of Western-style radical individualism, with individual people writing their rule of life. And that's not a bad thing. I'm very much for it. But historically, that was like unheard of. A rule of life was designed to hold a community together around shared rhythms of formation. And most churches have some, they don't call it a rule of life, but you know, your church meets on Sundays, I'm guessing, in this room. And you probably have times, and I don't know all the details and the contours of the architecture of your church and your community. But every church has some touch points and some rhythms, but often they're just limited, and they tend to be really good ones. We just need often a more expansive view that is specifically designed for the cultural moment that we're living in. And so, you know, it's hard to Sabbath, for example, because the world does not Sabbath. And so you're trying to go against the inertia of the entire culture around you. But it is a lot easier for our family to Sabbath. You know, we do things, crazy things, like we turn all of our devices off, including my teenagers, for 24 hours, put them in a black box that goes in a closet. It's easier to do that when there's 15 of us around our table and we're all practicing Sabbath together, and they're putting their phones in too, and we're all starting at 6 p.m. at the same time, and we're praying together, and we're doing a huge feast, and we're entering. And we might be the smallest alternative community in the city, but we're the resistance, you know, there's 15 of us, but we're the resistance. And there is something about not just I keep Sabbath, but we together keep Sabbath. And we end with a movie night on Saturday nights afterwards. Like, there is something about that, and that's just a micro version, mm-hmm. that is so doable. It doesn't cost money. It doesn't require a PhD. You can just hawk it with your friends, and it's awesome. So I don't want to give you an ambiguous answer. I think that churches can be places where people are trained in how to integrate practices from the way of Jesus into their daily life, and where a community offers a vision of life with Jesus, and of how to, of not just the teachings of Jesus, but of how to obey the teachings of Jesus, how to develop a life architecture that will allow God to have access to the deepest part of who you are. And it'll allow people to go on the relational journey. But I think the Sunday experience has to be a means to an end. It has to be really getting people off stages and around tables, and off listening and learning just in the brain to embodied practice. And that doesn't mean that what happens here is not crucial. It just means this has to be seen as the beginning of the discipleship journey, not the end point.
Selah.
This podcast is from Practicing the Way. We develop resources to help churches and small groups apprentice in the way of Jesus. And all we make is completely free because it's already been paid for by The Circle, a community of monthly givers who partner with us to see spiritual formation integrated into the church at large. Special thanks for today's episode goes to Ekaterina from La Mirada, California, Matthew from Hagerstown, Maryland, Katrina from Westland, Oregon, Chris from Austin, Texas, and Ruth from Hamilton, Michigan. Thank you all very much. To join The Circle or to learn more about running a practice in your church or community, visit practicingtheway.org. Until next time, may the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all.